The opinions and statements expressed in the following program do not necessarily reflect those of WWDB, its staff, or management.
Good day, everyone, and welcome again to another edition of Boomer Generation Radio. This is your host, Richard Address, coming to you from the studios of WWDB AM 860 here in Greater Philadelphia, and we are streaming live on WWDBAM.com. This portion of Boomer Generation Radio is being brought to you by Kendall, a system of not-for-profit communities and services that advocate for and empower older adults to reach their full potential. Kendall is committed to working with others to together transform the experience of aging. And to learn more about Kendall, that's K-E-N-D-A-L, we invite you to visit www.discoverkendall.org or call them toll-free at 888-759-0128. That's 888-759-0128. And you can reach us at boomergenerationradio@gmail.com. And also we invite you to go on the Facebook page, Boomer Generation Radio on Facebook, and like us or click on the like thingy there and make everybody happy, including Mr. Facebook, I would imagine. We are very pleased to be joined by the magic of electronics and our producer, Tony Ginny Bigar, who is with the U.S. Against Alzheimer's organization and is the director of that organization's Clergy Network, which is a recently formed interfaith coalition developed to help fight Alzheimer's. Ginny, are you there?
Yes, good morning.
Hi. It's always a surprise when it works. I have full faith in our producer, Tony, and not in my electronic abilities, which are basically, as my daughter tells me, zero. So welcome.
Thank you. There's lots
to talk about here. There's so much happening, it seems to be, every day with Alzheimer's issues. And so first of all, why don't we talk about literally what are these two organizations that you're involved with?
So I work for Us Against Alzheimer's, and Us Against Alzheimer's is about 4 years old, and our mission is to find a treatment, prevention, or cure for Alzheimer's by 2020. And backing up from there, there's obviously quite a bit to do to get there. So the organization is, as a whole, really interdisciplinary and is focused on every step of the pathway to a cure. So we advocate for more research dollars. We are working in on reforming clinical trials and that system globally, and trying to activate people to enroll in clinical trials. We work with industry, encouraging them to share data so that there's more information about drug successes and failures, and that information is accessed faster. We're also working to fix an antiquated regulatory pathways that really slow down getting drugs to market. And we also strive to get rid of barriers in government reimbursement and that block access to these drugs when they're available. So all of that is, you know, George Radenberg and his wife Trish Radenberg, who founded Us Against Alzheimer's, they felt that to cure this really horrible and deadly disease, that business as usual was not going to accomplish that, wasn't going to solve the problem. And so they founded Us Against Alzheimer's to really to disrupt the state of advocacy and the state of the approach to a cure, which they just felt there was no urgency. And so that's been the goal, and we're working on all of those areas. And one of the ways that we work with individuals is through networks of disparately affected people. For instance, we have African American network, Latino network, and those two groups are both twice as likely to develop Alzheimer's. So we felt really important to mobilize those groups of people to to advance the work for a cure and also better care for individuals with Alzheimer's and for their families.
So what's the clergy network? Because I know so you're, that was just started recently.
Yes. So the clergy network was we started last summer. And we have some activists, Linda Everman, Dr. Danny Potts, just really smart and engaged activists who said, you know, we really need to get the faith community behind this. And so that's the great thing about Us Against Alzheimer's is that we are always looking for opportunities to advance this work and just thought this is an incredibly important voice to have. And so we recruited leaders. It's interfaith. The clergy network is an interfaith network. And so we recruited leaders from all over the country, yourself included. We have 17 faith traditions represented, and we have people who lead congregations. We have people who lead, you know, districts of churches who are theologians and thinkers to really get behind the fight against Alzheimer's. And the mission of the clergy network is a little bit different than some of our others in that very focused on the fight for a cure, but also it's a voice that can promote dignity, compassionate care, and quality of life for those with Alzheimer's and for their families. And also, importantly, congregations and houses of worship are where many, many people go for support. And so just felt it was really important to mobilize the faith community behind this.
So we're being told by especially the Alzheimer's Association that the 5 million people dealing with Alzheimer's now in 2015, within the next 25, 30 years, as our generation, as the baby boomers age out, is going to jump to about 15 million.
Mm-hmm.
The urgency is, it's not fiction anymore. It's here. It's here. And between Alzheimer's, the whole dementia rubric seems to be, because so many more people are dealing with it, seems to be getting much more play in the press. You mentioned, Janie, that you're working on regulatory issues with the drugs. How many drugs are being fast-tracked? What's the story with that? Because I know people, I would say, are the people I've spoken with and who are dealing with this, they are, I think the word desperate is a good word, to find some drug, pill, something that will delay this as long as there's still no cure. How are you working on that?
Yeah, there are, let me just pull that up, there are a couple of there are medications that are currently available that treat symptoms, mm-hmm. and those are well known, I think, by Aricept, Exelon, Namita. Right now, the drugs on the horizon are solanezumab, which is a Lilly drug, and then two other pharmas have drugs that are expected to be available in 2018 and 2020, respectively, Biogen and Azion. And I may be pronouncing Azion correctly. So there, George, our founder, believes that there's a lot of hope among researchers. The drugs that are specifically, have sort of target dates to be available, but that there's enough, that's sort of in the pipeline that may produce results. But that's where we go to, there are not enough people enrolled in clinical trials, and that is a critical part of the process.
So if somebody's listening and they want to find out about how to get involved with a clinical trial with dealing with Alzheimer's, where would you tell them to go? How do they begin to access that information? Go ahead.
Well, there's a couple of things that somebody could do. We're working right now with the Brain Health Registry. And the Brain Health Registry is It is a clinical trial. It basically asks participants to answer a lot of questions, and they'll be tracked over time. Their brain health will be tracked over time. And it also, trialmatch.com or .org is another place that people can go and see what's available. The nice thing about a registry is that the hope is that, you know, once there's a database of people who are, you know, potential candidates for clinical trials, that a trial can seek those people out, mm-hmm. those individuals out. So I'd say the Brain Health Registry would be an excellent place to begin.
So what about your what about Us Against Alzheimer's? What's the website in case somebody wants to contact you and just cruise the website and get some more information?
Website is usagainstalzheimers.org.
Okay.
And there's information on clinical trials there. I think that that's a great way for people to get involved in that and also get involved in advocacy, because we offer opportunities. If you join Us Against Alzheimer's, we offer our supporters an action every week that is specifically designed to move the needle on this, whether it's advocating for additional research dollars, which is a huge concern, very underfunded, or finding out about clinical trials or the clergy network.
The underfunded, the you know, you just you mentioned that. Talk to us a little bit about the truth about that. In this country, where does funding for Alzheimer's research stand in the roster of things?
Well, Alzheimer's disease, first of all, is the most expensive disease in the country.
Why? Why?
Because the care, you know, the care that's for people who have Alzheimer's, Medicare costs and others. So the national cost in 2013, for example, was $215 billion.
How much?
And that, of course, is going to skyrocket, you know, as more and more people have the disease.
Okay, well, say that again. $215 billion.
Mm-hmm.
Billion dollars in what, 2014?
2013
cost just to care for people with Alzheimer's.
Exactly.
So that's figures from 2 years ago, a year and a half ago, and with the baby boomers now all over the age of 50, and given the projections of the Alzheimer's Association, you're really talking about to care for a patient with Alzheimer's. Billions and billions and billions of dollars.
It truly is a crisis in, you know, every sense of the word. But the public funding, to answer your question about public funding, the funding for Alzheimer's research is really a fraction of what we invest in other diseases. Just for example, cancer receives $5.4 billion, HIV/AIDS, $3 billion in public research funding. Alzheimer's receives approximately $550 million. And, you know, really expert researchers believe we need about $2 billion a year to meet the goal of preventing or treating Alzheimer's by 2020.
So
it's just the public investment is just not there. So I do think, though, that there is – we're seeing more and more that the many more people are speaking out who are facing Alzheimer's, families and individuals with Alzheimer's, and that there's more and more coverage of that. And as baby boomers age, as you said, it's just you know, I think that there is much more awareness of what it is doing to families and what it's going to do to the country.
We're speaking with Ginny Bigar, the director of the Us Against Alzheimer's Association's Clergy Network, this interfaith group, and also associated with Us Against Alzheimer's, U.S. Against Alzheimer's. It's www.usagainstalzheimers.org, right?
Yes, exactly.
We'll be back with Ginny just in a couple of seconds after we bring you this word from Kendall.
Hi, this is Kendall staff member Sheila Sylvester. This portion of Boomer Generation Radio is brought to you by Kendall, a system of not-for-profit communities and services that advocates for and empowers older adults to reach their full potential. Kendall is committed to working with others as we together transform the experience of aging. To learn more about Kendall, that's K-E-N-D-A-L, visit discoverkendall.org or call toll-free 888-759-0128.
Welcome back to Boomer Generation Radio, coming to you from WWDB AM 860 here in Greater Philadelphia and streaming live on WWDBAM.com. And we're with Ginny Bigar from Us Against Alzheimer's and the Interfaith Clergy Network, dealing with raising awareness about this this disease. Ginny, what was the impact of this movie, Still Alice, on public perception and your work?
Well, I think that, I think it was any time you have, Alzheimer's, in our case, featured in a movie like that, and Julianne Moore winning the Oscar, and Glenn Campbell's I'll Be Me being nominated in the music category. I mean, it's excellent for, again, raising awareness about this disease and getting people engaged. And for those who haven't experienced it, you know, they can really see the impact that it has on people's lives. And so we really try to work closely with individuals with Alzheimer's. I think that it's so important to have those people and those families engaged in our work. And right now I'm working with a man named Greg O'Brien, who has early onset Alzheimer's, which is when people are diagnosed before age 65. And Greg is a journalist and an author and a really incredible storyteller. And so I'm going to be working with him on a series of webisodes, and just we're going to kind of follow Greg on his journey through Alzheimer's. And I think he's an incredibly engaging person, and as I said, a great storyteller. And so I think Still Alice really brought home to us the incredible power of the personal stories in moving people, whether it's policymakers, scientists, and others.
You mentioned the family. For those of us who've worked with families or experienced this personally, you know that this is a family systems issue. So could you talk to me a little bit about how Us Against Alzheimer's really also works with the family, the spouse, the children, the grandchildren? Because this really impacts, especially as you alluded to, this is not something that's over and done with in 6 months. This can take years. It may sometimes decades to play out.
Yeah. Oh, and it's – yeah, we – again, while our focus is really on that pathway to a cure, it's just been very important to work with, when we can, families and people with Alzheimer's. And the Clergy Network has actually been an excellent vehicle for that. We published a book called Seasons of Caring, Interfaith. It's a book of meditations for Alzheimer's and dementia caregivers. It's an interfaith book, really excellent, and you're one of our contributors, so thank you again.
Well, how can people get a hold of it? Because it really is a very, very lovely work.
Yeah, it's gotten great, great reception. You can find it through our website as well as by going to seasonsofcaring.org and learn about the book. You can see a few pages of the book and find out where to get it. And so that's been, I think, a huge success of the Clergy Network. We're also, Us Against Alzheimer's maintains a closed Facebook support group. It's the Us Against Alzheimer's community. And we have five moderators, women who have all been caregivers themselves. And we have about 4,000 members right now. And it's been very successful in that it's a real time, a place where caregivers can go and ask questions, a huge range of questions in real time, and get immediate responses from a very knowledgeable group. Situations they may be facing in the moment, longer-term questions, frustrations, sharing information. So That's if for people who are on Facebook, you would just search for Us Against Alzheimer's Community and ask to join that group. We felt it important to keep it a closed group because it just gives us a little more control over, people speak freely, but we just felt it important to sort of maintain the community feel of the group. So that's another way that we're working to support caregivers and families. We're also working on an initiative called Dementia Friendly America, and this is an effort to create dementia friendly communities of every sort, whether it's faith communities, cities, towns, all kinds. So working on that as well.
Is there still a large element of fear associated with discussions about Alzheimer's?
I think so. I think that it's still, I'm sometimes reminded how many people really don't know that much about it. And I think it's because people who are dealing with it still don't talk about it. It is terrifying, and I think it's terrifying to learn about, and it can be terrifying to talk about. But as we've seen with so many other diseases, it's a very, very important part of getting to that prevention or cure.
If my parents have Alzheimer's, developing, a mom or a dad, is that a guarantee that I'm going to inherit it?
It's not. And I will say I am not an expert in that particular area, but I know that it is not a guarantee. From what I understand, I think it will end up being similar to cancer in that there are different kinds of cancer that people get different ways. But I think that that's one of the keys to finding that prevention or cure is really understanding the disease better, understanding Alzheimer's better. Women, for example, African Americans and Latinos are more likely to get it.
Do we know why?
Than others. No. Researchers are beginning to understand why. They have some sense that with some groups it could be a contributing factor, maybe poor overall health care. It may be hormone related, but that research is so important to understanding why those groups are disparately affected.
Is it men more than women or women more than men, or we don't know?
Women more than men. Women
really?
Are twice as likely to have Alzheimer's, yes.
Mm-hmm. And we don't know why?
No.
So
again, there are indications of what might be the cause of that, but very important to understand that.
So is there, because I seem to have recalled reading some stuff about this as well, and Us Against Alzheimer's may be involved with this, and you can tell us about some of the genetic components, that they're looking at genetic components, predispositions to this?
There is a marker, and again, I'm going to tread lightly on this.
That's okay.
It's not my area of expertise, but there is a marker that some people have, a genetic marker that I think can show a predisposition for Alzheimer's. And I know people who have it and mm-hmm. Maybe there's a kind of a long history of Alzheimer's in their family, and so they got that genetic testing done. And right now, ideally, when a prevention or treatment, really good treatment is found, you will need to be able to diagnose it, if you have it, be able to tell if you're genetically predisposed. And but right now I think there's a lot of fear about finding out because there's a feeling that you can't really do anything.
Well, before we start running out of time, there's one other issue, and we're not going to be able to cover everything in this first segment. But can you comment a little bit, if you can, through your work with Us Against Alzheimer's? This is not just an issue in the United States of America. I've seen reports that other countries are experiencing also this rise in cases of Alzheimer's, and it seems to be that this is really part of this global age wave and some of the tragic
Absolutely.
Consequences of this. Could you comment on what you're seeing if you're tracking certain things around the world and where you seem where it seems to be most relevant or prevalent?
Well, as you said, there are about 5 million Americans who have Alzheimer's or dementia, and 44 million people worldwide are estimated to be currently dying from Alzheimer's, many in developing countries where maybe the health overall health care is not as good. And also, again, more than are dying from HIV/AIDS, cancer, or chronic heart disease. So it is absolutely a global problem. Us Against Alzheimer's is doing quite a bit of work in that area, particularly in the UK. We have another one of our coalitions is the Global CEO Initiative, which brings corporations around the world together to tackle Alzheimer's and gets them engaged in the path on finding ways to get to that prevention or cure. So absolutely, it's a global problem, and we're focused as well in that area.
Did you say that? I want to make sure I didn't mishear you. That globally, more people are dealing with Alzheimer's than with cancer and AIDS?
Yes.
Wow. Wow.
Yeah.
Okay. That I would guarantee you that most people are not aware of that. But they could. This also could go to the whole fear factor as well. Listen, before we're bumping up against the end of this segment. So, for the people who are listening, and Ginny Bigar from Us Against Alzheimer's and the Interfaith Clergy Network Against Alzheimer's, what's the one or two key things, Ginny, that you would suggest to families who are just beginning this process or they're walking down this path? What are one or two things that every family must be aware of?
Well, I think beyond the obvious, working with their family physicians on the proper medical care, I would say speak out about the disease, bring it out of the shadows.
Mm-hmm.
And be active, get active, join Us Against Alzheimer's and speak out, on the need for a demand. A treatment, prevention, or cure.
And how do we get in touch with you at Us Against Alzheimer's? What's the website?
usagainstalzheimers.org. So www.usagainstalzheimers.org.
And is the US capitalized?
Not to find the website, no. It
okay.
is written as one word. So usagainstalzheimers.org.
.org.
And join us, and we give our supporters an action a week we feel is going to be effective in moving policymakers and others who can move us toward the prevention or cure.
Ginny, thank you very much. And if there are clergy
thank
listening
you.
As well, you can go to that same website, www.usagainstalzheimers.org, and there's an icon or whatever it is on the clergy network as well,
yes.
If I'm not mistaken.
And thank you for your support.
No, my pleasure. And,
yeah.
and for those of you who are listening or interested, that Season of Caring book, it's seasonsofcaring.org. Definitely a wonderful book of meditations and readings. Very, very spiritual. Very, very helpful. Thank you, Ginny, very, very much.
Thank
and we
you
wish you
so
continued
much.
Good luck with Us Against Alzheimer's.
Thank you. Thank you, Rabbi.
For those of you listening here on Boomer Generation Radio, a couple of friends of ours who wanted to say hello, the Hecht Investment Group of Janie Montgomery Scott. A good friend of ours, which always provides concierge financial consulting and planning services. The Hecht Investment Group uses a formal investment process as their foundation. Clients receive frequent communication and rapid response to questions. And as many of us know, there are few needs greater than our own when it comes to personal financial planning. The Hecht Investment Group provides experience, guidance, and an efficient management process that is very important in today's environment. Additionally, Peter Hecht and his team can assist you in connecting to the investment banking department, who specialize in assisting middle market companies achieve their strategic goals. We invite you to contact the Hecht Investment Group toll free at 855-289-2168, or you can visit them at hechtinvestmentgroup.com. The Hecht Investment Group is also on Twitter, LinkedIn, and on Facebook. And Johnny Montgomery Scott is a member of the New York Stock Exchange, FINRA, and SIPC. You know, we're talking a lot about in these last couple of weeks and even just now alluding to the obvious things with the Alzheimer's concerns about having conversations that are very, very difficult. And we're reminded by our friends at the Samaritan Healthcare and Hospice in southern New Jersey to think about what would happen if a surgery or accident or serious illness prevented you from speaking for yourself. Would your loved ones know your wishes? And obviously, would you know theirs? Samaritan Healthcare and Hospice reminds us that now is the time to think, to talk, and to act. Think about what you'd want if you couldn't speak. Talk about your wishes with those who matter to you and act by writing it down. And most people, as we've talked about a lot here on Boomer Generation Radio, understand that these conversations, these delicate conversations, are not best held in the crisis moment of an ICU, but really to be started around the family kitchen table or den or family room, and they really take some time. If you already have an advance directive, we invite you to find out today about talking the talk goes far beyond the legal living will that your lawyer may have helped you complete. So we invite you to go to Timely Conversations, and that's part of Samaritan Healthcare and Hospice. You go to SamaritanNJ.org/think-talk-act to get in touch with Timely Conversations. That's SamaritanNJ.org/think-talk-act. That's part of the Samaritan Healthcare and Hospice in southern New Jersey. We've also, every once in a while here on Boomer Generation Radio, like to make you aware of certain things that are happening around the country that may have some interest to you related to boomers and older adults. And we've been asked to mention today that today is Low Country Giving Day, May 5th, Low Country Giving Day in Charleston, South Carolina. And there's an organization that's really helping to restore one of the National Historic Registry cemeteries, a cemetery that dates back to 1764. That's before the Phillies started losing. The Cumming Street Cemetery in Charleston, South Carolina. And if you would like to get involved in learning more about this cemetery and how to get involved with helping its restoration, we invite you to go to a Facebook page, KKBE Charleston. That's KKBE Charleston on Facebook. And there's a video that you can look at https://vimeo.com/125469962 with an exclamation point. And if you want more information, you can go get this information on the Jewish Sacred Aging website or the Facebook page of Boomer Generation Radio on Facebook, and that'll give you the same information. So it's Low Country Giving Day today on May the 5th. And we're going to be back with our second guest, Mr. Horowitz, who's standing by right after this little musical bridge courtesy of an old rock and roll group. Welcome back to Boomer Generation Radio. This is your host, Richard Address, coming to you from the studios of WWDB AM 860 in Philadelphia and streaming live on WWDBAM.com. And again, you can contact us at BoomerGenerationRadio@gmail.com or Boomer Generation Radio on Facebook. That was a fool on the hill with some cellos. It's a very interesting CD that has some very interesting arrangements of classic Beatles songs. And we are, speaking of classics, we are delighted, I hope, to welcome from Atlanta, Mr. Alan Horowitz. Alan, are you there?
Yes, I am. Thank you very much, Rabbi.
Hi. Good to speak with you. Alan Horowitz, practicing in health law and member of law firm Arnold Golden Gregory in Atlanta, Georgia, whose focus is representing providers, mostly in skilled nursing facilities. And you have a very, very exciting and varied background in healthcare and law and nursing, et cetera, so uniquely qualified from a variety of perspectives on both sides of the aisle, so to speak, of dealing with issues related to patients' rights and residents' rights. So this is, I admire your bio. It's very, very fascinating. So welcome, Alan, to Boomer Generation Radio. There's so much to talk about. So let me just ask you at the beginning, talk to us a little bit about what you do at the firm dealing with residents' rights, patients' rights in, let's say, assisted living or nursing home facilities.
Sure. And I'll answer that by saying that my focus primarily deals with facility practices, nursing facility practices, resident rights, as it relates more to skilled nursing facilities, which are regulated by federal laws rather than assisted living facilities, which are regulated solely by state laws. Most of the 15,000-plus skilled nursing facilities in the country, the overwhelming majority are Medicare providers, Medicare and or Medicaid, and when a nursing facility agrees to be a Medicare provider, which is their choice, they agreed to follow federal regulations dealing with resident rights, the quality of life, quality of care, issues ranging from resident dignity, respecting residents' dignity, and their freedom of choice, and certainly maintaining their safety. My particular focus with Arnold Golden Gregory is helping facilities in making sure that they're in compliance with all of the federal regulations that relate to nursing facilities. Oftentimes, and just by way of brief background, prior to joining the firm of Arnold Golden Gregory, I represented the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services, CMS, which is the operating division within U.S. Department of Health and Human Services that oversees all Medicare providers and enforces the regulations and from time to time imposes fines against nursing homes or, in extreme case, will terminate a nursing home from the Medicare program, which essentially will put the facility out of business. So I have been on both sides while I prosecuted and litigated cases on behalf of the federal government in the past. To the extent it's appropriate, I will defend nursing facilities because, quite frankly, and I used to say this even when I did work in the government is not always right and providers are not always wrong. So my focus narrowly is dealing with nursing home residents. And generally, it would be a situation where the government might be alleging that some federal regulation was violated or that a particular facility is not in substantial compliance. Alternatively, and this is one of the things that I enjoy most about what I do, it gives me an opportunity to work with skilled nursing facilities, chains, and meet with folks at the corporate level or board level and encourage them to take a very proactive approach, not just getting involved after there's been an issue with the government, but to be proactive, because at the end of the day, it's all about the safety and the quality of life of the residents who live there.
So can you describe, given that background, thank you very much, can you describe how residents' rights and needs are being managed in these skilled nursing facilities? Because there's so... Look, with the aging of the baby boomers, well, a lot of us have seen situations with our own parents, And, you know, the raw number statistics is a lot of us are going to wind up there.
Exactly. And just to put that in some context, over a million people every day are dependent on nursing homes for some level of care. And according to a recent report in the U.S. News and World Report, a majority of people over the age of 65, which incidentally includes me as we speak, will require some type of long-term care services in their lifetime. And 40% of folks in this country will need a period of care in a nursing home. So this, if it doesn't affect us directly, those of us that are 65 or older, more often than not, it affects family members, elder parents, or elder siblings. In terms of your question about how resident rights are protected, it's a very broad question. For example, a resident has a right under the federal regulation to self-administer medications. So if a resident had emphysema or asthma and had a metered dose inhaler that he or she used routinely, just because they're now a resident in a nursing home doesn't mean that they couldn't self-administer that medication. It's their right. After all, the facility for long-term stay resident, that is their home. However, the really tricky issue for facilities around the country is respecting resident rights while ensuring their safety. So if the same resident needed a medication in the form of, let's say, a metered dose inhaler, if the resident had some cognitive impairment or functional limitation, couldn't, you know, if it required two puffs, if that was what the prescription required, two puffs of the medication every 4 or 6 hours, and they either couldn't remember or to take it as ordered, or they didn't have the manual dexterity, then the resident's safety component would trump their right to self-administer medication. Now, the way facilities are required to deal with that under the federal regulatory scheme is to have an interdisciplinary team assess each resident in that instance to find out if that resident is capable of self-administering a medication. That's a pretty straightforward and easy example for a facility, and facilities are good at evaluating whether or not, for example, a particular resident can self-administer medications. The more difficult issue that we're seeing throughout the country, not just in Pennsylvania, it's in every state and virtually every nursing facility, issues, and especially with boomers now entering nursing facilities in large numbers, what the administrators of facilities are often finding is that oftentimes residents want to be intimate, sexually intimate, with a spouse. Occasionally, if it's a widow or widowed resident, perhaps with another resident. And while that's a resident's right, and in fact, we all have a basic need for intimacy, it's a normal emotional component, the problem for facilities is when a resident is cognitively impaired. If a resident had, and I listened to your earlier guest talk about Alzheimer's, but if a resident had a form of dementia or Alzheimer's, and to the point where that resident couldn't give consent to sexual intimacy with another individual, that's problematic. And that's a very fine balance where the facility, on the one hand, has to respect the resident's right to be intimate, but on the other hand, they have to make sure that the resident has a cognitive ability to know what he or she is doing and to give consent.
Right.
Very murky.
Right. I know that the recent case in Iowa, Mr. Rayhorn, who was acquitted last week he was prosecuted on, I think, felony sexual abuse charges for exactly what you're talking about. His wife had passed away from Alzheimer's and this last August, and this was being just now adjudicated in the law. And I know that there are various homes who do have codicils that protect the patient's rights for sexual intimacy. But I would imagine that you are 100% correct. As the population ages, as boomers age, and perhaps one spouse is not in the facility and the other is, that these issues are going to really grow. They really have to. And so the protection of a person's rights, is there any way that as somebody enters a nursing home, are there discussions about this type of like sexual intimacy if you feel the need, this is protected, or is it not even discussed?
Well, I would strongly encourage a resident and certainly the resident's family, a responsible party, to have that dialogue and discussion prior to admission, and a broad-ranging discussion about what, for example, it would be perfectly legitimate to ask the administrator or the director of admissions, whomever the family is meeting with, what is your policy on intimacy for the residents, and how do you both respect the residents' right while safeguarding the health and safety of the resident? And I think that becomes an even more important conversation when a resident, or prospective resident, has some degree of a cognitive impairment. And I think having that discussion up front is, I would say, is critical, just to avoid any problems down the line and to know if it's a good fit and if philosophically there's an alignment between the needs of the resident's family, and the facility. And the reason I mentioned philosophical alignment is fairly recently, I'd say within the last year or two, I don't remember the exact month, the CMS issued a directive that nursing homes cannot discriminate in terms of sexual intimacy based on, or in terms of any form of discrimination based on a same-sex couple. The long-term care industry is, there are many facilities that are just coming to terms with that. There are some organizations that maybe because of a religious orientation did not encourage or permit or recognize same-sex couples.
Right.
As you know, many states have just passed laws recognizing that. But the federal government, and again, this federal law trumps state law, so the federal government has clearly said that there cannot be discrimination against a couple. So if, in fact, a same-sex couple both required a skilled nursing facility, the facility could not refuse to admit them because of their sexual orientation. But again, that's the questions such as how a facility respects residents' rights broadly as well as specifically are the sorts of discussions that should occur prior to admission. Another example, just briefly, is smoking. There are some facilities that have a designated smoking area and will permit someone who's admitted to smoke in that smoking area. And they will do an assessment, or they should do an assessment, to see if someone can smoke independently or if they need supervision. But if somebody has been a chain smoker for 40 years and they're thinking about or they require a skilled nursing facility, one of the key questions, unless they're able to quit smoking, which is always a good idea, but if they can't and they've tried it and they've been unsuccessful at that, then a key question in that instance would be, what is the facility? Does the facility permit smoking? Is there a designated smoking area? Which brings up an interesting point. Residents have, and this is something that physicians often wrestle with, but just because an individual goes from their home or some other setting to a nursing home, they don't give up their rights. And that means that residents have the right to engage in, to some extent, self-destructive behavior. So if someone has emphysema and they wanted to smoke and the facility had a designated smoking area, the facility couldn't stop the resident from smoking unless, of course, there was a significant safety issue to other residents. For example, if a resident was on oxygen, there's a clear danger that you can't smoke while you're on oxygen.
We're speaking with Alan Horowitz, a lawyer from Atlanta, Georgia, who represents providers, specifically mostly skilled nursing facilities around patients' rights. And we'll be right back with Alan right after this word from Kendall.
Hi, this is Kendall resident Harry Hammond. This portion of Boomer Generation Radio is brought to you by Kendall, a system of not-for-profit communities and services in 8 states that advocates for and empowers older adults to reach their full potential. Please join us in together transforming the experience of aging. To learn more about Kendall, that's K-E-N-D-A-L, visit discoverkendall.org or call toll-free 888-759-0128.
We're back again here on Boomer Generation Radio. This is your host, Richard Address, again coming to you from WWDBAM 860 here in Philadelphia and streaming live on WWDBAM.com. Back with Alan Horowitz from Atlanta, Georgia, our lawyer who is talking about patients' rights. You just mentioned two things very, very important for families to think about when they're contemplating going into or placing somebody in a skilled nursing facility: the issues of smoking, the issue of sexual intimacy, sexual practices. So for people who are right now perhaps facing this challenge and dilemma and stress, Alan, what should a person and the family look for other than these two things when considering a placement in a facility?
Well, one of the suggestions that I have, and probably the top of the list of suggestions, would be to check out a nursing facility on a website that's operated by the government, in particular the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services. The website is Nursing Home Compare, and folks can get to the site by just doing a Google search for Nursing Home Compare, or I believe it's www.cms.gov, and then entering the term Nursing Home Compare. Nursing Home Compare is the federal government, in particular Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services, a database of all 15,000-plus nursing facilities that are in the Medicare program. And by the way, every nursing facility that's on that site, all 15,000-plus, has a star rating, and CMS refers to it as a five-star rating. So nursing facilities, every nursing facility that's a Medicare and or Medicaid provider will have a star rating from one star to five stars. Five stars is very much above average. One star is very, very much below average, three being average. Ideally, a facility would want a family would want a facility that's a five-star facility because by objective metrics, that's an excellent facility as opposed to a one-star facility. Again, let me hasten to add, there are other factors that a family should consider, but I think that that is very important, and that's a place that I recommend individuals to start with.
I just want to make sure everybody get, because that's a very, very important site. It's www.cm.gov.
Right, which stands for the Centers for Medicaid Services. But yeah, once on that site, this individual can just key in the term nursing home compare, and that will take an individual to the government, to the CMS nursing home compare site. The utility of that site is, I think, very helpful because not only does it give an overall rating from one to five stars, but there are three different categories where the government rates every nursing facility, from staffing, inspections, which are the annual surveys that every nursing facility has, as well as quality metrics. And that's particularly useful. So, for example, on the Nursing Home Compare website, there would be, if someone in Pennsylvania was thinking about finding a nursing facility for a loved one, they could go on that site, and if the loved one, if they were concerned about, for example, the use of antipsychotic medications, well, there are 18 quality measures, and an individual could see at a particular nursing facility, and you can do it by the name of the facility, by zip code, by county, by state, you could find out what the incidence is of residents who were not on antipsychotics but were newly prescribed antipsychotics, which is a serious concern.
Mm-hmm.
And individuals could see what the percentage of residents, both short stay and long stay, at that facility would be. And not only that, but an individual could then compare it to the state of Pennsylvania. And by the way, in Pennsylvania, the average use of antipsychotics, newly ordered antipsychotics in Pennsylvania for short-stay residents is 2.2%. The national average is 2.4%. So Pennsylvania is ahead of the national average on that. For long-stay residents who are newly prescribed antipsychotics, according to the Nursing Home Compare website as of this morning, Pennsylvania's average is 17.8%. The national average is 19.3%. Drilling down further, a family could find out if that was a particular concern. which facility had the best statistics, if you will, regarding the use of antipsychotics. Likewise, for falls with serious injuries, by going to the Nursing Home Compare website, a family or loved one can find out what the incidence is at that particular facility, compare it to other facilities, compare it to the state average in Pennsylvania for all facilities, and compare it to the national average. So I think that perhaps one of the best tools, not the only tool, but one of the best tools is the Nursing Home Compare website, because that has information that's ostensibly objective. It also has the survey reports, which can be very useful. Every nursing facility is surveyed at least once every year, 15 months at the longest. And if there are complaints filed by a resident or a family member or even a staff member, there's a complaint investigation, and that triggers the survey. And those survey findings are available on the Nursing Home Compare website. So if a particular nursing facility had serious deficiencies, which are violations of the federal regulation, they will appear on the website. There's other useful information, such as whether or not the government has fined a particular facility within the last 3 years based on deficiencies.
So this website, again, for those of you, this is a very, very important website, www.cms.gov. And then when you get to that, you can look for Nursing Home Compare. And this is a wealth, evidently, Alan, this is unbelievable, a wealth of great information that I would imagine as people, because this is a very stressful thing for people to have to do on a whole variety of levels, as you know. But to get information, if you're armed with information that you can hold and look at and then do comparisons, that's going to make your job of placement, as difficult as that is, perhaps a little bit easier. So from what I'm hearing you, that there, well, let me, because we only have about a minute left, real quick. If somebody sees or thinks that there's a problem with their loved one in a facility, how do they begin to rectify? Do they call somebody like you? Do they go to an elder care lawyer? What's the first line of defense?
Well, and that's an excellent question. My personal belief is, and I felt the same when I was with the government, it's not as if my answer is going to change because I represent providers. I think if there's a concern that a family has, they should approach the nurse and the administrator of the facility. Or if they're not satisfied with the nurse caring for a loved one, the director of nursing or the administrator. If there's not a satisfactory response from the administrator or the director of nursing, then I think the next level of reaching out might be appropriate. And that could either be the long-term care ombudsman in Pennsylvania, or it could be CMS. But again, the first, I think in my experience has been most concerns are resolved at the facility level by speaking with first the nurse caring for a loved one, the director of nursing or assistant director of nursing if it needs to be elevated, and or the nursing home administrator.
Thank you, Alan Horowitz from Arnold, Golden & Gregory in Atlanta, Georgia. This is lots of good information in this website, www.cms.gov, on patients' rights and advocacy. And thank you very much, Alan, for doing what you're doing. It's very exciting, and I appreciate your time. Good luck.
Thank you.
Continued success to all of you here on Boomer Generation Radio. We'll take care. We'll see you next time. Stay healthy. Stay safe. Thank you.